This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, November 25th, 2020. I'm Caleb Brown. These days, the Electoral College is largely presented as a massive, unwieldy obstacle to more democracy. So how has it worked historically? And who were the people who went rogue and became what I like to call conscientious electors? Emily Conrad is author of a new book, The Faithless, The Untold Story of the Electoral College. In 2016, I believe it was October 2016, I was in Utah for a Cato Institute event, and I had a chance to sit down with Senator Mike Lee of Utah about the Electoral College. And of course, he's a former prosecutor, himself somebody who's studied the Constitution extensively. And I asked him, what prevents an elector in the Electoral College from deciding, I don't care what the state legislature said, I don't care what voters told the state legislature to do, I'm going to vote for somebody else when I go to Washington, D.C. and put in my vote with the Electoral College. And he said, absolutely nothing. I mean, he didn't say nothing. He said the words absolutely nothing. And so we've had a Supreme Court case more recently that says states may punish so-called rogue electors. I like to think of them as conscientious electors. But all of this goes to the core, as you were saying before we even started recording, most Americans at the most basic level do not understand what their votes for president actually mean, what substantial impact they actually have. Why is that a problem?
Well, it's a problem because we have this system in place, and the system, the rules of the system are, in my view, they're actually quite clear. Now, unfortunately, they differ from state to state. The Electoral College differs state to state, which makes it slightly difficult as a researcher to really say this is what the Electoral College is. But at the end of the day, everybody's experience and every voter's experience in the United States is remarkably similar, because on election day, we're not voting for the president. We're voting for electors who then choose the president on our behalf. And that's what it is. To act like it's something different than that is actually factually incorrect. But you take a look at our news media and a lot of and even civics education, they don't quite explain what the mechanisms behind the Electoral College or how our president is selected.
I was about to ask, how does the news media handle this? How well do they perform at making clear that when you vote for president, that is a right that you have in a sense? It's not really even a right as we understand constitutional rights. It is a delegated power from state legislatures.
That is an interesting thing, and it is certainly coming out to play in 2020. What's interesting for me about the Electoral College is that you take a look, and every single year you have these debates around it, and then almost immediately after, all the debates just kind of dissipate and they go away, and then they're brought up again 4 years later. You did talk about the Supreme Court cases. That really made, that was really groundbreaking whenever we saw Chiafello versus Washington and Colorado versus Baca. But in some ways, it made the system even more complicated. Already, if you take a look at the Electoral College, all these different states have different ways by which they select their electors. And then in some states, you have the two different major political parties. Democrats may select their electors differently than the Republican Party in the state. They have different mechanisms, different laws behind saying who can be an elector, who cannot become an elector. And then now, you have, after the Supreme Court ruling, you now even have different laws which say a faithless elector can or cannot be, or as you like to say, a rogue elector. It's extremely interesting because now in some states, you have an elector who cannot, who will, if they vote faithlessly, will be removed. And then maybe in the neighboring state, the vote will be cast and they will be fined. And then maybe in the state next to that, the vote will be cast and they won't be fined. So now, after the Supreme Court cases, what you start to see is that the Electoral College is even more disjointed than before. And for me as a researcher, it becomes even more difficult to really get a sense of how is this system actually working? Because there really isn't, besides the Constitution saying electors can't hold work for the federal government, there's not really much else other than that that says somebody can or cannot be an elector.
You wrote an entire book here about what I like to call conscientious electors, what other people call rogue electors, people who did not follow through on the wishes of their state legislatures. What's the most notable story here?
That's a really difficult question for me to answer, because I did interview 8 electors, and they were both Republicans and Democrats. And interestingly, while their narratives were similar in the fact that they all made a choice not to vote for the winner of their state's popular vote, they had different reasons for doing so. For me, I really enjoyed L.J. Guerra's narrative. This was, of course, the only other female that besides my own, I guess, my own narrative that is represented in the book. She was 18 years old when she was chosen as an elector in her congressional district caucus in Washington State. And at the time, she was a community college student, and she was just getting involved in politics. And one of the major things that everybody wants to do is go to the national convention. Well, she was from a less privileged background, and she said, there's no way that I could pay to go to the DNC. But being an elector, it's being a part of the process, and it's also free to participate in. So she ran a campaign, made speeches, was voted in as an elector by her congressional district caucus. And then whenever she really was faced over the summer with what it meant to be an elector, she realized that she was kind of in a red district and that maybe many of her constituents would not support Hillary Clinton as their president. So she, as an 18 years old, started going around to local Walmarts and mom and pop shops, conducting her own straw polls. And in that process of just talking to people in her community, she decided to vote for Colin Powell instead. And so I thought that this was extremely interesting because she was a young, from a not so great background, community college student, Hispanic. And it really shows that the Electoral College, we often think it's this filled up with a lot of the criticisms that it's filled with kind of old, rich white men. I mean, the Electoral College is actually remarkably diverse. And almost all of my stories and the electors, they all are very diverse individuals, from Native American activists to a former refugee from South Vietnam, very diverse individuals. And they were all electors in the Electoral College.
So, it's probably a good moment to dwell on this a bit, but how are they selected? Given the history of electors, I would think that the slate of electors chosen by parties would be faithful members in good standing of the party who are going to do what's expected of them.
And that's one of the things that I also assumed starting out. And I was very interested in why would people, because I mean, basically, what I knew about the Electoral College is that party faithful would become electors. At least that was my assumption going into it. And I began to think, looking at that 2016, you saw both Republicans and Democrats not vote for the winner of their state popular vote. I began to think, what is happening that the party faithful are willing to do something that seems so futile and give up their reputation and standing within their party, which they've clearly devoted a lot of time to. So it's actually quite interesting, and it differs state by state. Basically, some states, they are democratically selected within a congressional caucus or state convention. In other states, they are selected by the party chairman. So the Republican Party chairman or the Democratic Party chairman. And then in other states, like, for example, in Pennsylvania, they are selected directly by the candidates themselves or the candidates' teams themselves. So it really differs state by state. And yes, it does make a difference. I think that the people who are elected as electors, earlier on, feel much more empowered. So out of the 8 electors that I interviewed, 7 of them were elected by their peers to become an elector. only one of them was appointed there by their state chairman.
One of the stories that you tell here is about Roger McBride.
Yeah.
And he is well known to libertarians as a faithless elector, someone who in 1972 decided not to go with his party's wishes. Who was Roger McBride?
Well, the Roger McBride was, I think he's also known for being a presidential candidate for the Libertarian Party as well. One of the reasons why I chose to focus on his narrative, actually, I was introduced to him through another elector that I covered in my book, Bill Green, and he decided to vote for Ron Paul in 2016 rather than for Donald Trump. And he had experience with Roger McBride and viewed Roger McBride as one of his mentors in the liberty movement within inside the Republican Party. And for me, that was, he said, oh, make sure that you include Roger McBride as you do your research. And the more I delved into the story of Roger McBride, I was really fascinated. Here you had this individual, you know, very capable individual. And I think that he really put the Libertarian Party on the map. I mean, you took a look in 1972, the Libertarian Party was on maybe, I think it was on two state ballots nationwide. Then all of a sudden in Virginia, you see this vote for the Libertarian ticket. It wasn't even on the Virginia ballot. So I just could only imagine the reaction that probably got from the fellow Republicans and politicos in Virginia. But for me, what it really showed was that a lot of faithless electors is a very interesting topic, because in this vote that Roger McBride had, it was the first time that a homosexual had received gay man had received an electoral college vote. It was the first time that a woman had received an electoral college vote, and it was the first time that a Jewish individual had received an electoral college vote. These were three firsts that were basically pioneered by a faithless elector. And you also saw this again in 2016, where you saw the first two electoral college votes for Native Americans. That was done by Robert Satayakam. He voted for Faith Spotted Eagle and for Winona LaDuke. So it's really interesting. Faithless electors have pioneered a lot of firsts, just thinking about our political environment and our political culture. Faithless electors have been constantly pushing the boundary, and then they kind of go kind of under the radar.
So this may be the more uncomfortable part, because you are a researcher. What do you think of the institution?
I think that at the moment, it has a lot of challenges moving forward. And the reason I say that is because you take a look at what happened in 2016. Basically, every single Republican elector was actively lobbied to change their vote. And as I mentioned before, a lot of these electors are normal individuals. They're kind of our neighbors. These aren't necessarily politicos. And for normal everyday Americans to be electors, to be given that responsibility, that honor, and then to find themselves bombarded, I think that's actually quite problematic. These are publicly elected officials, but we just don't have that cultural or political cognizance of what that is. So, I mean, I interviewed these electors. I mean, so many of them received death threats. They received boxes upon boxes of mail, phone calls at all hours of the night. And as I look ahead to 2020, I could see that also happening again. I think that it's problematic to not have a strong public cognizance over who are our electors, what do they do, and how do we treat them, and making sure that there's a certain level of safety there. At the end of the day, there are 538 votes for president that actually count. And people talked about foreign interference in the last election. I mean, a bad faith domestic foreign actor could easily try to insert themselves in this scenario, especially a lot of the individuals that I interviewed. I mean, that they're just everyday people. And so I think that's extremely important moving forward.
I don't know when this is going to come out, but as of this recording, the current president of the United States, Donald Trump, is trying to mount challenges to vote totals in a couple of states. And I guess my early sense of that, my suspicion, is he's trying to influence the Electoral College vote. How do you think there's any evidence for that?
Well, I mean, Donald Trump faced a huge challenge. A lot of people in 2016 were likewise trying to use the Electoral College vote to keep him from taking office. You had an entire movement called the Hamilton Electors Movement. Really, the two Supreme Court cases, Chiafello versus Washington and Colorado versus Baca, those were both Hamilton elective founders of the Hamilton electors, and their entire goal was to use the Electoral College to keep Donald Trump from taking office. So if that is, he has experience of it working the opposite way. I mean, they were attempting to get 37 Republican electors to defect to a more moderate Republican candidate to deny him the 270 to win. That being said, I mean, when you start taking a look at the Electoral College tallies, getting a lot of faithless electors to jump ship is extremely difficult. You might be able to get one or two, a handful here or there, people who are wanting to make their voice heard or their message heard. But what's interesting is that as I was researching in 2016, the more electors were actually lobbied, the more that they were, the more that they became more resolute in their beliefs. And so I think that it actually kind of has an opposite in effect in a certain way. But there were quite a few people that I've heard I haven't talked to them directly. But in 2016, there were many Republicans that were considering defecting from Donald Trump. Unfortunately, I have not been able to interview them. I mean, they're not going to come out and share their story. But based off of the other Hamilton electors, they were saying, oh, we're talking to groups in different states, including in Utah. And I think that was one of the things, whenever you mentioned Mike Lee, why Utah was so interesting. You saw Evan McMullen, and he had just a massive support on the ground. And I think that electors really were faced with a challenge, particularly the females the female electors who may not have liked Donald Trump as much. But that was, of course, before the Supreme Court rulings. And I think that Utah now has pretty strong binding elector laws, is my impression.
Following up on the Supreme Court case, if I understand correctly, the Supreme Court said that states may punish electors.
Yes.
But to what extent have states done that?
Well, there have been laws in the past. So basically, the Supreme Court said that state laws to bind electors are not unconstitutional. Thereby, you know, if a state doesn't have laws, you can assume that that a faithless vote or a rogue vote is constitutional. And, you know, the opposite also proves true. Before, you have 30-something states with some sort of binding elector law. Now, these laws just might be a fine of $1,000. It might be that your faithless vote will stand, but you may be criminally charged after the fact. And then a few states, 14, actually have laws that can remove a faithless elector during the vote itself. And that is what happened in Minnesota in 2016. You had an elector who wanted to vote for Bernie Sanders, basically voted for Bernie Sanders and was removed. And so so it's very interesting to see that. But most states actually don't have the legal apparatus to remove a faithless elector, to remove a rogue elector. So looking ahead, I think that the Supreme Court cases, to me, it just made the system slightly more complicated. At the same time, it's a lot of people, if you say that that your electors don't have to follow the winner of your state's popular vote, if you ask people if they agree with that, just kind of ask people on the street, all of them will say that they do not support faithless electors. So it's kind of it's an interesting thing. And of course, a lot of Democrats really liked the Supreme Court ruling. binding electors to the state's popular vote, because they said, oh, this might just be one step into getting electors bound to the national popular vote. So there was a lot of things going on at that point in time, and which makes the Supreme Court case so interesting when you start to unpack it.
How do you evaluate state level efforts at altering how electoral votes are apportioned? Maine and Nebraska are two states that have their own systems for doing so. Other states have signed on to a compact of sorts that will direct their electors at some point in the future. And if enough states sign on, direct their electors to support the winner of the national popular vote. How do you evaluate those reforms?
Well, the congressional district model of the Electoral College was actually something that was supported very strongly by Roger McBride. I think that he was basically thinking that this was a way that you could have a more plurality of voices within the political system. And it is true. What it does is that you saw Trump go to Nebraska for that one Electoral College vote in the week before the election. And so it is quite interesting whenever you start to think about implementing this district system in the Electoral College. And that's one of the things that I often mention to people, is that just a couple of changes to the Electoral College will dramatically change the entire system as we know it. If more states start to implement the district model, elections become much more competitive. And another thing that would happen is that you could see third parties really start to rise up, not to win the election, but just to keep major parties from winning the 270 necessary to win. So it would something like that would dramatically change the system. And I think that there's not enough dialogue behind what these changes can do. I researched kind of what happened in the past and what happened in 2016. And of course, now that we're into 2020, I'm researching what's happening with this Electoral College as well. But you know, one of the things I focus on when people ask me, I tell them just a couple of changes to the Electoral College will dramatically change our political climate and our political culture and how we select the president.
Emily Conrad is author of The Faithless, The Untold Story of the Electoral College. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast anywhere you please and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.